We want to share with you something we are very excited about. It's a personal oxygen bar. Now, we all know how important oxygen is. We know that the body and the mind both thrive on oxygen. Now, O2 Innovations, the creator of the state-of-the-art O2B personal oxygen bar, brings to you the power of oxygen and its ability to revitalize and rejuvenate. The O2B personal oxygen bar filters dust, and it delivers about 40%, plus or minus 2%, oxygen-enriched air at 3 liters per minute. It does this with a quiet operation, a sleek design, and best of all, it's user-friendly. There are no tanks, water, or refilling involved, but everything you need, including aromatherapy and relaxation CDs, is all part of this package. Breathing clean, fresh, oxygen-enriched air gives you the energy you've been craving. It replenishes and renews your spirit. I use oxygen when I meditate. It's fabulous. Oxygen is beautiful, and you deserve to be too, from the inside out. Visit O2Innovations.com to purchase your O2B personal oxygen bar and begin feeling the difference today.
Now, the moment that I've waited for now is what I was created for now. I'm gonna let you know what I'm feeling now. I must be quite emphatical. I'm feeling plain ecstatical. I might just float right up to the sea.
Hi, everyone. I'm Britt Elders, and once again, I'm sitting in for Shirley, who's on location filming. They're about ready to wrap, Elsa and Fred, but it looks as though she may have a couple more film projects coming up pretty quick. We'll keep you posted on that. Tonight, I've invited Dr. Robert Rosenberg, a sleep expert, to join us. Sleep is an important topic because most of us don't get enough of it, and sleep disorders affect not only your physical health, but your mental well-being. Dr. Rosenberg began his practice of medicine in Chicago as an associate professor of pulmonary and internal medicine at the Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine. In addition to teaching medical students, interns, and residents, he attended to different patients at medical schools affiliated hospitals. He moved to Arizona in 1982 to open a private practice in internal medicine, pulmonary medicine, and sleep medicine. Dr. Rosenberg continued his role as a teaching physician both in Arizona and in California. His practice is now limited to the specialty of sleep medicine, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, let's start with, what is an adequate amount of sleep?
That's a good question. It also depends upon the age of the patient. So if we're talking about adults, probably in the neighborhood of 7.5 to 8.5 hours is considered the norm. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, about 30% of people in this country, according to the National Sleep Foundation, recent surveys, are sleeping less than 6 hours a night and therefore getting an insufficient amount of sleep.
Right. Right. As you age, do you have a tendency to sleep less?
Well, as we age, we have a tendency to go to bed earlier and wake up in the, it's 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, so there's a circadian change.
Uh-huh.
And our sleep becomes lighter. We have less slow or delta sleep, which is deep sleep, mm-hmm. and more light stages of sleep. But our requirements for sleep are still, in most studies, for good health, in the neighborhood of 7.5 to 8.5 hours.
Wow. And I don't know anybody that actually gets that. I really don't. It's bad. What are some of the side effects of the lack of sleep?
Well, the big one in this country is obesity.
Uh-huh.
Insufficient sleep leads to obesity. And the reason is that when we don't get enough sleep, the body tends to produce hormones which really cause us to gain weight. There's a hormone called ghrelin, secreted by the stomach, which starts to go on overdrive, and that increases our appetites. There's a hormone called leptin, which is supposed to suppress our appetite and increase our calorie consumption. And that hormone is suppressed in people who don't get enough sleep. So we start to see the obesity problem. Then we begin to see increased incidences of heart attack and stroke and hypertension. And basically, when we sleep at night, we usually are our parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming nervous system, takes over. And our blood pressure drops about 15 points at night. It's called nighttime dipping. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're only getting 6 hours of sleep a night, then your sympathetic, the flight or fright system, is really being turned on an extra 2 or 3 hours during the course of a day. Your body's not getting a respite. And after a while, we find that people with lack of sleep begin to develop very high levels of adrenaline, catecholamines, and begin to develop hypertension. And unfortunately, we then start to see an increased incidence of stroke and heart attack in these people.
Oh, wow. We don't really realize how integral sleep is to being healthy. It also affects your memory, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it may help promote memory. There's some recent studies that show if you're studying for an exam, for instance, mm-hmm. and if you take an hour and a half nap prior to going into the exam room, or if your study is the test is the next morning and you've had a chance to sleep before the test, as opposed to studying in the morning and taking a test without any sleep in the afternoon or the evening, that the results are much better. That's called it's a function called declarative memory. And that kind of memory basically gets uploaded during what we call non-REM sleep. And therefore, sleep itself promotes the memory. And lack of sleep, people who don't sleep enough begin to have cognitive dysfunction and begin to have problems with memory, problems with that can sometimes be misdiagnosed as dementia, and they certainly have trouble with short-term memory.
Mm-hmm.
And scans of the brain begin to show in certain sleep disorders, we start to see areas of the brain involved in memory, such as an area of the brain called the hippocampus, begins to atrophy from lack of sleep, or in people with sleep apnea, from lack of oxygen.
Oh, my. Okay. What about depression? Do people that don't get adequate sleep suffer from depression more than others?
People who don't get enough sleep, for instance, insomniacs, have a very high incidence of depression. It's comorbid. As a matter of fact, one of the studies that we've seen in the psychiatric literature is that if you have insomnia and you have depression, and you treat the depression with antidepressants, and you get some improvement in the mood disorder, but the patient continues to have the insomnia because it has not been addressed individually, that the relapse rate of depression after 9 months is 2 to 3 times what it would have been.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing. How common is insomnia, is it?
Insomnia, if you define it as chronic insomnia, greater than 3 months of poor sleep, either an inability to fall asleep, stay asleep, or early morning awakenings, or another definition is just people wake up and feel as if they just haven't had a good night's sleep, non-restorative sleep. The incidence in the United States of chronic insomnia is about 15%. Now, the incidence of insomnia itself, how many Americans during the course of the year have problems with sleeping, some just what we call acute adjustment insomnia that may only last for a few weeks after a death in the family or a divorce or whatever kind of trauma, then we're talking maybe 30 to 40% of people.
Mm-hmm. And that is a major trigger to mood and anxiety disorders?
Absolutely. And both ways, yes. Frequently we find that insomnia, actually, it was interesting you bring that up. A study was done several years ago in college students who were followed over a period of 15 or 20 years. And those who had insomnia, persistent insomnia, during the study as early as college, had a very high incidence of depression up to 10 to 15 years later. So the insomnia may actually predate the depression. We also know that in adolescence, insomnia may predate suicidal ideation. So it's important that we get on top of the insomnia, that we deal with it before it turns into depression. And, of course, anxiety disorder is the same thing. Probably the leading cause of an inability to fall asleep of the comorbid psychiatric disorders is anxiety disorders, generalized anxiety disorder. And
wow.
If you don't address the anxiety disorder, it's highly unlikely that the insomnia will improve.
So it becomes kind of a huge wheel.
It is. It is. We used to think that if you treat depression or anxiety, that the insomnia got better and vice versa. We now call them comorbid. That is, we realize they're really comorbid conditions, and they each need to be addressed individually.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the common ways that insomnia is treated?
Well, certainly we could talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, which is something I like to do in our laboratories and with our patients if we can, and that is trying to avoid medication if possible.
Right.
And we first try to teach people sleep hygiene. We want them to understand that being on the computer late at night, drinking caffeine at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, especially in older folks where it may take 14 to 17 hours to metabolize coffee as opposed to when they were younger. There's a tremendous spate of energy drinks with all the caffeine involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
All of these habits are counterproductive, and as one of the reasons that the incidence of insomnia is so high. So we try to start with basic sleep hygiene. Then we try cognitive.
That's great.
then we try cognitive restructuring. In other words, people begin to catastrophize about their insomnia. The insomnia becomes the focus of their day. They get into the bedroom. They're anxious. They're anxious about the inability to sleep. They look at the clock. They begin to ruminate, and it builds up into a crescendo where there's no way they can sleep. So we try to teach them things like writing down at maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, write down your problems, try to write down some solutions, put them in your desk drawer, try not to catastrophize, try meditation, try relaxation techniques. And there's several techniques, one called stimulus control, where we tell the patients, if you get into the bedroom and you get into bed and it's half an hour has gone by and you're wired and you can't get to sleep, get out of the bedroom and go and do something relaxing. Read a magazine, you know, do a crossword puzzle. But the bottom line is then bring yourself back into the bedroom when you're really sleepy. And guess what? If it happens again, do it all over again. And it's a technique called stimulus control, which is probably one of the better techniques to deal with insomnia of that behavioral type of techniques that we use.
Mm-hmm. That is really fascinating. Is it absolutely necessary to have a very dark room to sleep?
It's very important, because what we're talking about in order to help you fall asleep is melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
And melatonin is produced by the brain in most people about 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Okay, the pineal gland starts to produce melatonin, and that really calms the hypothalamus, which is one of the wakefulness centers, down. Unfortunately, if you have bright light, as soon as it hits the retina, it goes to the brain, and it turns off the production of melatonin.
Uh-huh.
So it's very important to try to keep the room as dark as possible at night. That's why computers, video phones, video games in the bedroom, all of these things that shouldn't be done in the bedroom are counterproductive. Of course, there are people who can sleep through a war, but
my
we're talking about insomniacs. So in those patients, they really need to modify their behaviors. And in some cases, it's just a matter of them learning. Well, I will sit down with them and explain to them about melatonin and dark and so on. And once they get it, most people are very intelligent. Once they get it and they understand it, then they can take it from there.
Do you recommend supplementing with melatonin?
I do on occasion. We do use melatonin. We found it to be very useful in certain pediatric cases. We find autistic children, there's literature showing that that can help them with sleep. We have a lot of people who are shift workers or have jet lag. Melatonin certainly can help. And then we have a large group of people who have what's called delayed sleep phase syndrome. It usually begins in adolescence or teens. Kids can't go to sleep till 1 o'clock in the morning and end up having to try to get up for school by 6:30, and they just can't cut it after a while. And in those patients, melatonin is very helpful. And studies measuring their melatonin levels actually show that the problem is that they're not producing melatonin until 11, 12, or 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can use just a small dose of melatonin at about 8 or 9 o'clock and try to basically stimulate them and basically to a normal cycle, a normal circadian cycle. Frequently, this allows them to fall asleep and get up for school.
Is it common for teenagers and adolescents to have insomnia problems?
Very common. It's one of the major problems we have now, and that's also a major cause of obesity amongst adolescents and children. And one of the problems is, first of all, most parents, I shouldn't say most, but many parents do not realize that although they can survive on 8 hours, the 5 and 6 year old needs more like 11 or 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And even the adolescent in high school needs about 9 hours. So we find in some cases, it's because in the family, they really aren't allowed to go to bed at 11, 12 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock like mom and dad. So that's the problem.
Right.
The other problem is the kids are trying to burn the candle at both ends.
Wow.
We have a name for that now. It's called behavioral insufficient sleep syndrome. And it's not that these kids can't fall asleep. It's that they just don't want to. And they're just trying to stay up as late as they can. And unfortunately, that leads to a lot of problems in school, behavioral problems, oppositional defiance disorder, and ADHD. Many kids with ADHD really have underlying sleep disorders that are the cause.
Well, I did not realize that. So if a child is diagnosed with ADHD and they come to a clinic such as yours where they can learn what to do and you school them and teach them the proper hygiene, then they have a possibility of reversing that ADHD?
If we can, yes, that's they can.
Wow,
and even more importantly, what the literature is showing and what I'm seeing in my practice, and most of us sleep specialists who deal with children as well as adults, a significant amount of children with ADHD have underlying primary sleep disorders, the major one being sleep apnea. So sleep apnea in children can present exactly like ADHD. And so frequently a child who has been diagnosed with ADHD, if he has sleep apnea and they have their tonsils and adenoids removed, which in children usually serves to cure the sleep apnea, mm-hmm. in many respects, in many instances, they may actually come off of the Ritalin or the medications that are being prescribed for ADHD mm-hmm. because literally the lack of oxygen to the brain and the fragmentation of sleep because they're choking all night was what led to their inability to control their impulses, their inability to concentrate, and their hyperactivity.
That is amazing information. We hear a lot about sleep apnea on the news and magazines, all of that. What exactly is it?
Okay, well, sleep apnea, the major form is obstructive sleep apnea. It's basically when you go to sleep at night, your upper airway, your pharynx, the soft tissue part above your larynx, above your voice box, mm-hmm. That tends to collapse in people with sleep apnea, probably because it's actually smaller during the day. But when you're wide awake, obviously you're not going to allow your airway to collapse. We have what's called a wakefulness stimulus that would prevent that. But when we go to sleep at night, the higher brain centers basically go to sleep, the cortices and the prefrontal cortex, will become reliant on brainstem reflexes. And these reflexes, these brainstem reflexes, are incompetent or incapable in some people of maintaining an open airway because the airway is so small. So the airway collapses on the patient when they're breathing in because you're creating a negative pressure to get air into your lungs, and that negative pressure is like sucking on a straw. And if you've ever taken a straw and you pinch it about 80% and then suck on it, the straw will collapse. Well, that's what's happening to the airway. The airway collapses. When the airway collapses, your oxygen levels plummet, carbon dioxide levels go up, blood pressure will go up 30 or 40 points every time. There'll be a release of catecholamines, cortisol, stress hormones, and then the patient will suddenly awaken, not long enough to remember, take a deep breath, and then go back to sleep again. And this may happen 40, 50, 60 times an hour. And the body is actually being exposed to the low oxygen, to the high blood pressure, and to the numerous arousals. So the patient can't stay awake the following day. They're miserable. They're fatigued. They're depressed. And on top of that, their blood pressure is beginning to go up during the day. And then the incidence of heart attack and stroke and sleep apnea, presently we estimate about 3 to 5 times normal.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a major problem. And it also can destroy the wall of the heart. We used to think, we know that there are people who in the past were dilated with what we still call cardiomyopathies, and they would be called idiopathic, which means we don't know the cause, and everybody would assume they're viral or whatever. And in some cases, they may be, but we're now finding that in some people, it may be years of sleep apnea, stretching the heart and exposing it to low oxygen all night when you breathe against a closed airway, that begins to slowly, slowly destroy the muscle of the heart.
Oh, what does it do to the brain?
Well, it's not good. the initial effects are on cognition. The part of the brain that's very sensitive to low oxygen is called the prefrontal cortex. And that's basically where you do your reasoning, your impulse control, your calculating. So that part of the brain is being exposed to low oxygen levels, and then the oxygen goes up and down and up and down all night, which is even more damaging than just having low oxygen all night, because there's a release of what we call free radicals of oxygen. So there's damage to that part of the brain, and as a result, people begin to have difficulty with cognition, with memory, short-term memory, and planning, and can be misdiagnosed with early dementia, and have been actually. Unfortunately, they didn't have dementia. They had sleep apnea. So basically it does that. Then on another level, it begins to narrow the blood vessels to the brain. The brain begins to lose its ability to control. The brain has this unusual, unlike any other organ, it has an ability to control its own blood flow. So if the blood pressure is low, the brain will dilate the blood vessels and allow blood to get in. If the pressure is too high, the brain tends to shut down a bit and prevent the pressure from being from working on the brain. In sleep apnea, after a few years, the brain loses the ability to auto-regulate. And so it's being exposed to very high blood pressure at night when it shouldn't be. And the blood vessels begin to narrow. And eventually, the incidence of transient ischemic attacks, what we call mini-strokes, and strokes is extraordinarily high. And interestingly, people with sleep apnea tend to have their strokes at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, whereas most Americans have their strokes after 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. So they have it in their sleep.
Okay, how do we diagnose it? If someone suspects that they have sleep apnea, what do they do?
Well, first of all, they need to bring it to the attention of their healthcare worker, their primary care doctor, their nurse practitioner, and that's the first thing. And then the next thing is they need to be referred to a sleep lab, such as ours, and then we basically do what's called a polysomnogram on them, and we're monitoring their brain waves and so that we know what stages of sleep they're in and if they're asleep. We're monitoring the movement of air from the nose and mouth to make sure there is air movement. And we're monitoring the movement of chest and abdomen and muscles. So everything's being monitored at this time. If on our computers we see and on our camera that the patient stops breathing and they stop breathing frequently, what we usually do is we will put them on a machine called a CPAP that night. We try to get it all done in one night if possible. The CPAP machine is a machine that generates compressed air. It's measured in centimeters of water. It's very exact. When the patient goes back to sleep, my technicians slowly increase the pressure while observing the computer and the camera. until their airway is open and is splinted by the positive pressure, and the airway can no longer shut down when they're breathing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's treated with the CPAP.
It's one method.
What are other methods?
There are other methods are oral appliances. Dentists are becoming very skilled at this. They're called mandibular advancement devices.
Yes.
They work well in mild to moderate sleep apnea, and we judge that by the number of times you stop breathing an hour. So if somebody has mild to moderate, which means greater than 5 but less than 30 events an hour, that an oral appliance is a very reasonable alternative. They go to the dentist, and the oral appliance is sent to the dentist takes an imprint, of course, of their jaw and the teeth, and it's sent out. And then the dentist will slowly advance the device, the lower jaw portion of it. The idea being to bring the tongue out of the airway at night. And then usually they're sent back to my laboratory to confirm that indeed it's working. And then we test the patient with the oral appliance in place. And if it's working, great. If it's not working, but it's partly working, my technicians can actually have been trained by the dentist to advance it a little bit more in the laboratory. And in many cases, that resolves the problem.
Wow, okay. I want to get into
some
of the more abnormal behaviors of sleep, but first I want to ask you, what are the side effects of taking sleeping pills like Ambien? Because I know I hear all the time from people just talking about it,
right,
that, oh, Ambien's fine, it's not addictive and all of that. What happens to the body when you're taking a sleeping pill, though, and especially if you have sleep apnea?
Sure. That's a great question. The newer sleeping pills, let's start off with the sleep apnea. The newer sleeping pills, the Ambien and the Lunesta, do not increase sleep apnea because they do not have a muscle-relaxing property. The older sleeping pills, the older benzodiazepines, like clonazepam and Dalmane, they're very nonspecific. They hit a number of targets in the brain in addition to the sleep center. And one of the ones they hit is the muscle relaxing center. So they can make sleep apnea much worse. So that's the first thing. And, of course, they also have very, very long half-lives. In other words, time to metabolize. The newer drugs like Ambien and Lunesta have reasonable, usually less than 6 hours to metabolize. Whereas the older medications, for instance, Dalmane, may take 48 hours to metabolize. So it can hang around a long time. As far as the tolerance or the side effects or addiction, the older benzodiazepines can cause withdrawal upon sudden discontinuation, especially the shorter-acting ones. Mm-hmm. The newer drugs, and I'm not a great proponent, but I do use them, Ambien, for instance, and Lunesta, do not rarely, if ever, cause withdrawal. In fact, a study just came out. It's funny you mentioned that because it was last month. There was a study in the journal Sleep where they studied patients on Ambien for 8 months. And at the end of the first month, they stopped the drug suddenly to see what would happen. And there was no withdrawal and no rebound, meaning the insomnia didn't get any worse. And then at the end of 8 months, they did that again, seven more months of constant taking it every night. And once again, they didn't see any sign. There was no patients of any significance with withdrawal or patients who developed significant rebound insomnia. So it would appear that, at least in most people, these drugs are safe. Now, on the other hand, we have patients on Ambien who get up and eat in the middle of the night and don't remember it. We have patients who sleepwalk on Ambien. We have patients who drive their cars on Ambien. So it's not the safest drug in the world, but on the other hand, it is a useful agent, as is Lunesta and some of the newer drugs, in some of our insomniacs who just don't respond to anything else.
Is there a reason they don't respond to anything else?
Yeah, we think there may be a segment of people with insomnia who really have a chronic hyperarousal state. That's really being worked on now, but we think there may be a group who have higher cortisol levels during nighttime, have higher levels of adrenaline and catecholamines at night. For some reason, the body just doesn't turn off the production of the stress hormones in some of these insomniacs the way normally when you or I or most people go to sleep, the cortisol becomes unmeasurable and mm-hmm. as do the other catecholamines. So just, that's one theory. Now, we don't know if it's a, some, one theory is that it's a physiological thing and that it's, has to do with the pituitary gland and just producing too much of these stimulating hormones. And another theory is that, it has to do with behavior. And after years of behavioral problems that predispose to insomnia, the body secondarily produces too many hormones. So that's the debate that's raging right now. But while it's raging, there are some people who just fail all forms of therapy. We've tried cognition, meditation, everything you can think of, and they're miserable and they need to be helped. And we use sleep aids. We try to use them intermittently. But when we do, in many of these people, it really does work. And it really does help them.
Oh, that's good to know. I don't think people realize that there are different types of sleeping pills, and some of them will be more helpful than others, and especially those that have sleep apnea. How present in society is sleep apnea?
Well, the last study was 24 million people in the United States.
24 million?
24 million, estimated. And that only about 20% of them have been diagnosed. Another way to look at it is they say that about, by the time we hit 60, probably 12 to 16% of men and possibly 8 to 12% of women, women begin to catch up to, them, to men after the menopause, probably have sleep apnea. Well, not probably, I mean, they do when they've done these studies. And so those are the basic numbers right now. So it is an epidemic. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's an epidemic of obesity. And obesity is the major cause of sleep apnea. So it's not surprising that these numbers are what they are.
Do you find that people that had insomnia as a youngster or in younger years develop sleep apnea in their later years?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Not insomnia per se. However, again, you've been reading the journals lately. Actually, there was a study done just read it a few weeks ago where we're finding that a number of children who have an inability to stay asleep, not fall asleep safely, have underlying respiratory problems, predominantly sleep apnea. As far as insomnia itself, Childhood insomnia more commonly predisposes to worsening insomnia in adults and mood disorders, but not necessarily sleep apnea, unless the sleep apnea was the cause of the insomnia and it remained undiagnosed.
Fascinating. What about some of the abnormal behaviors? Now, I'm going to just tell a tattle on myself here. When I was about 13, 14 years old and going through puberty and all of that, I would get up in the middle of the night, go brush my teeth, take a shower, and go back to bed. I was sleepwalking. I didn't even know I was doing it. Is that common?
Yes. About 30 or 40% of children at one point or another in their life sleepwalk at least once. As far as chronic sleepwalking, more like maybe 7 or 10%. And most children who sleepwalk stop sleepwalking usually after puberty.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually the architecture of their sleep changes. However, there is a persistence of 2-4% of adults who either continue to sleepwalk from childhood or because they've developed new sleep disorders such as sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome, that can precipitate sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm. Explain restless leg syndrome, please, because that's something we hear about but we know nothing of.
Correct. First of all, we estimate that about right now 5% of men and 7 to 8% of women in the United States have restless leg syndrome. It is more common in women, and it increases with age up until a point. It's in the fourth or fifth decade of plateaus. Restless leg syndrome is the subjective sensation by you while you're awake that, usually after dark, that you need to move your legs in response to some uncomfortable sensation. It could be. Some people describe it as a tingling, a tightness, a burning. But the key is that while they're moving their legs or rubbing their legs or walking around the house, they get temporary relief. And when they stop doing that, the discomfort comes back. That is restless leg syndrome.
Okay. And that is related to sleep?
Well, it's related to sleep, that it's a leading cause of insomnia.
Uh-huh.
So many patients come to me. It's funny, we get insomnia referrals, especially the intractable ones, and the patient comes to me, they've been unable to fall asleep till 2 o'clock in the morning, let's say, you know, for the last 6 years. And no one's ever asked them about their legs. And I'll ask them, they'll go, yeah, I'm marching around the room at night, doc, or the wife tells me, or the husband tells me. And, you know, and in some cases, we treat the restless leg syndrome, and the insomnia resolves. And in some cases, it wakes them up. They wake up in the middle of the night with a desire to move their legs. So it's a very, very common disease, which is really not, once you ask the right questions, it's not that hard to diagnose. You just have to maintain a high suspicion for it in patients.
Mm-hmm. What about some more of the abnormal behaviors? Eating while sleeping, acting out one's dreams, and sexsomnia. I want to hear about this one.
Okay, all right. Well, we ought to first explain to the listeners that we divide the sleep into REM, which is dream sleep, and non-REM sleep. So we have what we call parasomnias, which means abnormal and undesirable behaviors occurring during sleep. That's what they are. So when you're talking about sleepwalking, night terrors, and sleep-related eating disorder, which is those are parasomnias that occur out of non-REM sleep, usually out of deep sleep or slow-wave sleep. The parasomnia of a sleep-related eating disorder is one that's becoming more frequently diagnosed. It's a form of sleepwalking. We find the patient goes to the kitchen. They have no recollection. Burners may be left on. They may be eating weird foods. In some cases, people have been known to ingest rye and acid, okay? Or they wake up in the morning and they find food in the bed. They have no recollection of doing this. And this has been associated with medications, Ambien being one, any of the sleeping pills, some of the antipsychotic medications. But in many cases, there is no obvious cause, and in many cases we find that it's an underlying sleep disorder like restless leg or sleep apnea, which partially arouses them. In other words, let's say you can't breathe, or let's say your legs are beginning to tingle, but you're in a deep sleep. But you don't quite wake up, but you come out of sleep enough so that you're stuck, and that's what sleepwalking basically is in a way. It's a dissociation between wakefulness and sleep. You're stuck in no man's land, and you're basically, the motor centers are awake and the higher cortical centers are pretty dull or asleep, and that is what we find in many people. When we can't find an obvious cause for it, if we bring them into the laboratory and we test them, we'll pick up a primary sleep disorder, which is what's triggering the problem. Mm-hmm. It can also be triggered by stress or by alcohol.
Oh.
Now, REM behavior disorder, which is the other one you mentioned, Britt, that would be a parasomnia or an abnormal behavior that occurs in dreams. That was only first recognized about 25 years ago. And what happens is these parasomnias, by the way, tend to occur in the second half of the night when you're more likely to be in dream sleep, whereas sleepwalking and the sleep-related eating disorder usually occurs in the first half of the night when you're in non-REM sleep. Uh-huh. Getting back to the REM behavior disorder, which I see a lot of, these are people who literally act out their dreams, frequently violent dreams, being chased, they're fighting, they're trying to escape for their life. They end up punching the bed partner. They end up breaking their hands on the bedpost. They throw themselves out of bed. I mean, it's a very interesting disorder that we are seeing, you know, quite a bit of.
What causes it? Do you know?
Yeah, a number of things. The first thing is there are certainly medications, some of the antidepressants, the Prozacs and Zacan, the tricyclic antidepressants can bring it on. So medications can bring on REM behavior disorder. But what's really important is it may be a predictor of neurodegenerative diseases that will occur in the next 5 to 10 years. We find that about 30 to 40% of people who have REM behavior disorder will go on if followed over 10 years or so to develop Parkinson's or Parkinson-like diseases, and even multiple sclerosis. We believe what's happening is that the disease strikes a portion of the brain, in the brain stem, very early on, before it manifests with its classic motor findings or whatever. And what's going on is when you go into dream sleep, I go into dream sleep, we're not supposed to be able to move. The only muscles that work are the diaphragm and the extraocular muscles. Otherwise, we'd all be acting out our dreams, which would lead to some chaos in the bedroom. So the bottom line is that the brain actually produces a chemical that it sends down the spinal cord and inhibits movement during sleep. Unfortunately, in these people, that part of the brain located in the pons seems to have been damaged, and it doesn't function normally, and it doesn't inhibit movement. It's lost its ability to do that. And so these folks can actually act out and move in their dreams.
Oh, my goodness. That would be frightening.
It is frightening, especially to the bed partners, because patients themselves have no recollection. But I've had people come in with broken jaws, with all types of injuries. Wives moved into the other bedroom, husbands moved into the other bedroom because of, and usually it's interesting, the characteristics, the violent dreams are totally out of character for these people. They're usually much more passive people than even you would expect.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely fascinating. What about sexomnia?
Okay, sexomnia. The sexomnia is, we have patients, and it's been well described. There's probably a number of people who've been put in prison who, for no fault of their own, may have had sexomnia. And there's also people who have used it as a successful defense. But basically, it is people actually carrying out sexual behavior in their sleep. It could be intercourse. It could be masturbation. It could be fondling. But they, for all intents and purposes, similar to sleepwalkers, and usually they have a history of sleepwalking, they have no recollection, if you wake them up, of what was going on. If you do tell them, they're terribly embarrassed. They have no idea because there's no memory for it. It's not being done consciously. I've had wives bring their husbands in, and complain, about the behavior, and I've had, and women are also about 30% of women, 30% of people who have sexomnia, women. It's not terribly common, but it's out there, and it's something people need to be aware of, and if they have it or a spouse has it, it's something they need to talk to their healthcare provider about, and if the healthcare provider is not familiar with it, because there are excellent treatments for it, then they need to go to a sleep specialist. And other things that can trigger it are excessive alcohol use, stress, and lack of sleep. Insufficient sleep can trigger sexomnia.
Okay, and there are treatments for that, though.
Oh, there are. There are drugs that can be medicated. Well, if you find an underlying sleep disorder, again, going back to sleep apnea, but again, that I have several patients whose sexomnia was cured when we treated the sleep apnea. But if you can either tell them to eliminate the alcohol, treat the sleep apnea, treat the primary sleep disorder, tell them to start getting 7.5 to 8.5 hours of sleep if they're trying to live on 4 or 5, in many cases they'll respond. If they don't, then there are medications, one in particular called clonazepam. It's an old drug, but it's very effective in very low doses in helping people with that problem.
Okay. Are there other sleep disorders, and are most sleep disorders and behavioral pattern issues, are they related to insomnia?
Well, insomnia is the most common sleep disorder, no doubt about that. Insomnia is the number one sleep disorder. But there are, in addition to breathing disorders of sleep and abnormal behaviors of sleep and insufficient sleep, There are cardiac arrhythmias that are related to sleep. There are numerous disorders related to sleep. So it's a broad, broad field. And, we do spend one-third of our living time asleep.
It's so necessary, though, because it's so healing. And most of us just don't get enough of it. One of the questions that has come up with many of my friends is people seem to be waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, that's a good question. There may be a number of reasons for early morning awakening. So one thing is it may be a primary symptom of depression. Okay, so one of the classic insomnia of depression, although depression can manifest with an inability to fall or stay asleep in general, but early morning awakenings in people with depression is a rather classic form of the insomnia. and is probably the most common. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. Number two is they may be experiencing sleep apnea during dream sleep, which is most commonly at 3 or 4 in the morning is when we go into REM sleep. And because during REM sleep, as we talked about earlier, all the muscles become paralyzed pretty much with the exception of the diaphragm. Everything gets weaker, and so your airway is far more likely to collapse in the early morning hours at 3 or 4 in the morning if you're going into dream sleep. You may be waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning due to nightmares, so that would be another reason to be waking up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Or is, as we get older, some people, as I said, begin to have a circadian change in their sleep cycle where they start to find, it's called advanced sleep phase syndrome, they start to find themselves going to bed at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and waking up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They're getting enough sleep, but they're unhappy because socially the rest of the world is asleep and they're not.
You're right. I can understand that. Do people have different rhythms? I mean, some people seem to be morning people. Some people seem to be night people. Is that natural or is
Absolutely. It all has to do with that circadian melatonin secretion we were talking about. And with really with core body temperatures, because what melatonin does is basically it triggers the body to drop its core body temperature. And when your body temperature drops, that is one of the main signals that causes you to get groggy and drowsy. So we have morning larks and we have obviously night owls. The night owls are the folks whose core body temperature may not start dropping till midnight or 1 in the morning. They're probably not putting out melatonin till midnight or 1 in the morning. And so they just can't get to sleep at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. It's just not physiologically possible. And then the opposite are the folks who put out the melatonin at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and wide awake by 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And those folks obviously do very well with a normal wake time diurnal job. And our night owls frequently gravitate to working night shifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm one of those people that I'm quite comfortable at night. And
yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, and you can change it if you have to. We can alter it. I mean, it's difficult, but we do have patients in order to make a living because they have to get up for work or whatever. We can help them by using bright light as a stimulus or melatonin or just behavioral changes that we try to teach them good sleep hygiene, but we can change it to a certain extent. But there's some people who are always going to be night owls, and they're always going to end up with working a late job. They don't do well in the morning, and they don't do well other than in the evenings.
Right. I have my best sleep between 5 and 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
That's when I am out and loving it. But I can get up early in the morning, too, and that isn't a problem. I just enjoy that deep sleep between 5 and 9 that I get.
And that's when your circadian clock is at its ebb, about 3 to 5 in the morning. So, yeah, that's not uncommon for many people who sleep their best at that time.
What about people that just go and go and go on 5 and 6 hours of sleep because they have to, because of their jobs
right.
and their commitments and all of that? What do you tell them?
I tell them that, if they're coming to see me, they probably have a problem already. But if we're just talking at a cocktail party, friends, I tell them statistically, it's likely to catch you, that lack of sleep. I said, you know, I hope it doesn't. But the incidence of, again, that's what we call behaviorally induced insufficient sleep syndrome, meaning your behavior, it's not that you can't sleep, it's that you have the opportunity to sleep, but you won't sleep. And those folks, they say, I sleep late on the weekends. And we tell them, well, that really doesn't repair the damage done during the course of the week from the lack of sleep. And you're young and your body may be able to handle it. But if you're getting into your 40s and your 50s and you're still trying to do that, it's far less likely that you're going to be able to handle that before something unfortunate may happen to you in the way of cardiac or cerebral vascular or developing high blood pressure or diabetes or some type of a problem such as that. Not to mention, most of these folks have a hard time just functioning. I mean, concentrating and they become irritable and moody and they don't realize it's because of their lack of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to have a minimum of 7 or I'm toast.
Right, right.
You don't want to be in the same room with me.
I know what you mean.
Now, what about people that sleep a lot? I have several friends that they don't feel rested and comfortable doing their daily tasks if they have less than 9 hours of sleep.
Right. They're called long sleepers. And we used to think, the long sleepers also had problems in terms of it would lead to medical problems the way short sleepers do. But some of the more recent studies show that does not seem to be the case in the long sleepers, and that people who do sleep for 9 to 10 hours don't seem to be at as high a risk as the short sleepers who sleep less than 6 hours for developing problems. But those people require more time for their brain function to restore. I mean, we don't know. We're not even, you know, some people say, to this day, there are experts who aren't sure exactly what sleep does. We know it has a restorative function. We know it has some changes in brain plasticity, which you need during sleep. But bottom line is there are some people who only function with 9 or 10 hours of sleep. And if you limit them to 7 or 8 hours, they don't do well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to have to wrap up pretty quick.
Sure.
But what would you recommend for people that need to get a good night's sleep? What natural things do you recommend to them?
Well, first, environmental. Get the room dark, okay, is what I recommend. Turn off no television in the bedroom, especially in kids, but even in adults. No bright lights. So avoid caffeine and do things like that. If you're still having some problems, occasionally using a melatonin over the counter, as little as 1 milligram, taken 1 hour before you want to go to bed, may be helpful. But if you continue to have the problem and it's ongoing, then it's time to go and see somebody knowledgeable in sleep and to find out what's going on, because there may be an underlying problem. It could be an overactive thyroid. It could be any number of things that are contributing to your inability to fall or remain asleep.
Mm-hmm. So it really takes looking at the complete physical,
absolutely,
of the being, as well as the mental side,
right,
of the being, to get them to a position where they can really get a good night's sleep.
Right. In sleep medicine, we really have to look at the whole person. It's not just Ambien and Lunesta. You've got to look at the metabolism, endocrinology, GI, cardiovascular, and you have to look at the person mainly emotionally. All the people who come to my lab take a complete battery of tests, psychological testing. Some kind of happy about it before they come and see me for the first time.
Mm-hmm. And your lab is in Prescott Valley in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Right. We have a sleep lab in Prescott Valley, the Sleep Disorder Center in Prescott Valley. We have a sleep lab in Flagstaff. And we have a website to help people answer sleep questions called Answers for Sleep, which is also available. And if people want to submit a question on the website, I'll be more than happy to personally answer it.
I learned a lot from reading that website. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
I was quite surprised to read so much about the sleep and weight issues and how that goes into diabetes and the whole. That was fascinating.
Good. I'm glad you got something out of it, because it's important that through this program, for instance, that we make people aware of this.
It is. I've had issues with sleep before when I've been traveling or things like that, and I know how desperate you become to get a good night's sleep. So it's what you're doing is very, very important. And educating people, letting them learn about it, putting a website together like you have so that questions can be answered for both adults and children, it's just wonderful. I really appreciate the work you're doing there.
Well, thank you, Britt.
And thank you for joining us. It has been a fascinating hour. I hope you stay in touch. I'd love to have you back again and maybe take some questions from our listeners next time.
Sure, anytime. It'd be my pleasure.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenberg.
Okay.
Everybody, click on the website, on the webpage, the radio page, and you'll go right into his webpage. You will be amazed at the information there. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and tonight's health and wellness session, ask yourself how you're sleeping. Find the answers that work for you. Remember to be in a quiet, still, dark, cool room, preferably with no electronics, so there are no EMFs to interfere with your sleep. Talk yourself into a great sleep and try to get at least 7.5 to 8.5 hours every night for your optimum health. Thank you. Have a wonderful evening. Good night.